Venerable Chodron is away on a five-week teaching tour in the East Coast, Smith College, as well as Europe. She's in Italy and Germany, or she will be, and also in Moscow. So that gives us a chance to do some review of the Lam Rim teachings that she's been giving the last few months. So let's begin by cultivating a positive motivation. And tonight, since we're going to be talking about the sevenfold instruction of cause and effect for developing bodhicitta, I thought to share with you a quote from His Holiness. This is from his book, How to Practice, The Way to a Meaningful Life. In the introduction, His Holiness says, "I travel to many places around the world, and whenever I speak to people, I do so with a feeling that I am a member of their own family. Although we may be meeting for the first time, I accept everyone as a friend. In truth, we already know one another profoundly as human beings who share the same basic goals. We all seek happiness, and we do not want to suffer." So I find this quote very, very touching, very meaningful, and I think if we could honestly say what His Holiness says in this opening paragraph, that we accept everyone we meet as a friend and feel that we're a member of their own family, then wouldn't we be much happier people seeing others in that light? And wouldn't we experience much greater peace of mind and well-being, centeredness? And wouldn't we possibly have fewer problems like anger and anxiety and depression, loneliness, feeling isolated? And wouldn't we feel like our life was profoundly meaningful if we truly had that attitude towards others? So right now we may feel this way towards a few select people, maybe our partner or our parents or our children, or maybe a few very close friends. But what about the people that we see at the grocery store as we go up and down the aisles? Or the person standing in front of us at the bank, or the person in the car next to us as we wait at a light. So I invite you to take a moment to imagine having that kind of warm, open-hearted regard for all others, friends, enemies, strangers alike. And allow your heart and mind to expand to touch that reality where we can know one another profoundly at the most fundamental level, recognizing our deep innate desire for happiness. These teachings for developing bodhicitta have the potential to awaken that warm, caring, open-heartedness in each one of us. So tonight, let's engage in this review of the sevenfold cause and effect instruction for developing bodhicitta with a genuine intention to begin cultivating or perhaps increasing this altruistic attitude in our own mind. The Dalai Lama often says that the best way to improve our minds and hearts is to cultivate altruism, and I think that's Buddhist code for developing bodhicitta, maybe compassion and bodhicitta, the mind of enlightenment, the mind that wishes to achieve enlightenment for the welfare of others. And from my perspective, I think bodhicitta is one of the sanest minds that we can have, that we can cultivate. Why? Because it's based on compassion. And compassion is the main cause, the substantial cause for developing bodhicitta, this very expansive wish to achieve enlightenment for the welfare of others. And it wishes, that bodhicitta is based on compassion, which is wishing for all sentient beings to be free of suffering, So that's like a basis, a foundation for bodhicitta. And so if we reflect back for a moment, how is it that we begin developing compassion? We find that in the middle scope, we're encouraged to develop a kind of compassion for ourselves. When we engage in the Four Noble Truths and we're thinking about the first truth, the truth of suffering or the truth of dukkha, that we're beginning to reflect on the nature of our conditioned existence and beginning to identify and recognize and relate to the fact that we, because of our conditioning due to karma and afflictions, we're subject to all sorts of suffering or dissatisfaction or dukkha. And so there are different levels of suffering, different levels of dukkha, but particularly we hone in on that pervasive suffering of conditionality, the very fact that our body and mind are not under our control. So we might like to think that we're in control of ourselves, and to some gross degree we are. You know, we can get up in the morning and get dressed and decide how we're going to spend our day, but we're not in control of the aging process. We're not in control of if and when we get sick. Probably most of us won't be in control of our death process, the timing of that, the conditions of that. So this leaves us in a very vulnerable position, actually. There's no ground to really find, no security that we can cling to, you know, other than the teachings of the Buddha, the three jewels. So by understanding the nature of our own dukkha, our own conditioned existence, then we can begin to understand how every other living being is in the same situation. Just like us, they're suffering due to being controlled by their karma and their disturbing attitudes. And just as we want to be free of suffering, we want only to experience happiness, then we can assume that that's true of all living beings. So to generate genuine compassion, and especially great compassion, for all living beings, then first of all, we have to feel a sense of closeness to them. I was trying to think, there was a word that Venerable used for that. Heartwarming love. Right. Heartwarming love. So we need to cultivate this heartwarming love for all beings. And so there are very specific steps, precise steps that we can engage in to do that. And to make sure that we develop unbiased love and compassion and bodhicitta, then we begin by first developing equanimity. So it's a little awkward that right off the bat we're engaging in the sevenfold instruction of cause and effect, and there's eight steps. But there you have it. So the first one is equanimity. It's not included in the seven, but it's very important as a precursor. So here we're developing equanimity that's similar to the equanimity that we cultivate in the four immeasurables. You know, may all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free of bias, attachment, and hatred. Although there the focus is wishing for others to have this expansive mind, free of bias. But here in this practice, we're specifically focusing on developing equanimity in our own mind, in our own attitudes. And I like the way Rigpa Rinpoche described this. He said it's like if you wanted to paint a picture, a portrait, then first of all you'd prepare the canvas. And, you know, nowadays you just go down and buy one. It's already pre-prepared. But in the old days, you'd have to stretch it and make sure it was really smooth so that the paint could be applied evenly across the entire canvas. So that's really what equanimity is like, is that we're preparing our mind to be very even, very smooth, without all the ups and downs of attachment and aversion for attachment for friends, aversion for enemies. So I imagine that many of you have already done this meditation many times, and you've already discovered just how biased we are, how we're constantly categorizing people into friends, enemies, and strangers when we come in contact with them. We're asking ourselves, you know, has this person helped me? Have they harmed me? Have they neither helped nor harmed me? And right away we can see it's all about me, isn't it? It's focused on the I. And even within the category of friend, it's easy to discriminate. Well, this is my best friend. This is a casual friend. This is an acquaintance. So we're constantly discriminating in this way based on how they've helped me. I was very moved by some of the comments that Venerable Chodron made last Tuesday in her talk at North Idaho College. The topic was the power of respect. Most of you were there, but maybe some of the people watching haven't listened to that yet. It's on the the YouTube channel, Srivastava Abbey YouTube channel, is worth listening to, I think. She cited meditating on equanimity as an important part of Buddhist training for how we view others. And she said that equanimity helps to free our mind from attachment towards friends. We can still have friends. We're not trying to negate friends, but we're trying to lessen the attachment that we have for friends. We're trying to lessen the anger or the aversion that we have towards enemies or difficult people, people we find challenging, people we find different from us. And we're trying to lessen the apathy or the indifference towards everyone else, the people we might consider strangers, the people who haven't yet helped us or harmed us, so we can be indifferent towards them. We're trying to lessen that. And this helps us to develop an equal, open-hearted, caring attitude. She really emphasized that. Like, we're not trying to make our mind flat or dull by meditating on equanimity. Not at all. But rather, we're developing this equal, open-hearted, caring attitude towards others. She emphasized that to see people as equal, we have to look deeper than just the superficial appearance that they give in the world. So we have to look deeper than the person's race or ethnicity or nationality, their gender, or maybe their religion or their political views, to find something that is actually equal in every living being. And it reminded me of this quote by His Holiness, how he sees everyone he meets as a friend or as a member of his family. So she went on to say that what makes all beings equal is also what makes them in one way or another worthy of our respect, worthy of our care and our attention. The fact that all living beings want happiness and want to be free of suffering with the same intensity that we do is that commonality. And we're also equal in being worthy of deserving, worthy or deserving of happiness and freedom from suffering to the same degree that we have that desire and that worthiness. So this is what we're aiming for when we're meditating on equanimity. I like the approach that Kamala Shila takes in his stages of meditation. He suggests two very clear approaches for cultivating this attitude. The first is to contemplate from the other living being's point of view. And so to do that, we meditate on the fact that friends, enemies, and strangers equally want happiness and do not want suffering. And when we meditate on that deeply, then we can come to the conclusion that it's inappropriate to hold some close and dear and to help them and to, you know, discard others, keeping them at a distance and not helping them. And then the second point of view is from our own perspective, our own point of view, that we, if we have continuously been reborn since beginningless time, all beings without exception have played all three roles. They've been our friends, they've been strangers in countless lives, and they've also been our enemies. So let's look at this a little bit more closely. From other living beings' point of view, it's difficult to maintain constant awareness of that simple fact that all beings equally want happiness and want to avoid suffering. Actually, I'm not sure we even maintain a conscious awareness of it for ourselves, that how we spend our day, every choice we make throughout the day, from the time we get out of bed till the time we go to bed at night, all the different choices, the hundreds and thousands of choices that we make through the day, there's this unconscious thought, what's going to bring me the most happiness, isn't it? When we fill our bowls at lunch, that's what we're thinking. What's going to bring me the most happiness? but the same is true for others. And so in his book, Cultivating Compassion, Jeffrey Hopkins hypothesizes that it's difficult to stay aware of others have that same desire, just like us, because we know ourselves through feeling. We can feel, we can experience what's going on for us. But we only know others through sight. And so that's an interesting distinction to be aware of. We're looking at others, we're feeling our own experience. So we're primarily concerned with our own feelings or experiences of warmth and cold, hunger and thirst, experiences of pleasure and pain. But we don't have the same kind of awareness of others. So we may think, may all sentient beings have happiness and be free of suffering, but it's challenging to genuinely feel that. And so this is the method that he suggests in his book for cultivating equanimity. So I'm going to invite you to do this short meditation. We'll do this together. So first call to mind a dear friend, someone who's easy to be around, someone whose company you really enjoy. Think of someone very specific. See their face. And think, just as I want happiness, take a moment to feel that. And just as I want to be free of suffering, take a moment to feel that. The same is true of my dear friend, say their name. They also want happiness and don't want suffering. And again, try to feel that that's also true for your dear friend. That the feelings are equal. Just as I want happiness and want to be free of suffering, the same is true of my friend. He or she also wants happiness and doesn't want to experience any kind of suffering. Then let's extend this to someone we might consider a stranger. Think of someone you've seen recently, but you don't really know them. Maybe someone in your neighborhood or a coworker, someone you see regularly at the, maybe someone who works at the grocery store that you go to. Think of someone specific. And again, think, just as I want happiness and want to be free of suffering, and really feel how that's true for you. Just as that's true for me, the same is true of this person that appears as a stranger. They equally, with the same intensity as I, they want happiness and they don't want any suffering. And try to feel that as being true. And likewise, we can extend this to someone we currently find difficult. Think of someone who you find challenging, someone who pushes your buttons. Think of someone specific. And really make an effort to feel their desire for happiness and their desire to be free of suffering. So again, thinking, just as I want happiness and I want to be free of suffering in every moment of the day and night, even in my dreams, feel that. The very same thing is true for this person who I currently find challenging. They want nothing more than happiness. They want nothing more than to be free of every kind of suffering. And again, try to feel how that's true. So what did you notice? Did that have any impact on thinking of others? Any depth of experience? Were you able to actually feel? Probably it's easier to feel the friend's wish for happiness and avoiding suffering. What about strangers?
Lately, I've noticed with this one that it's easier actually with strangers, because there's no history. So there's no clinging attachment, there's no aversion, and you can look at someone and see that just like me, you know, our bodies and minds are not in control. And you can see, like, if I go to the gas station, you know, often it's evident on someone's face that it's difficult just making it through the day. Mm. So that, you know, can evoke a feeling of concern and compassion.
Actually, it broadens my mind to, you know, to include, of course, strangers. Because otherwise in daily life I would just be ignoring them. So it's a very valuable practice to bring them just to heart as I bring those who are close to me. Mm. Yeah, and it needs so much time, I'm so sure, to really make it to a deep, deep practice that we really feel it from the bottom of our heart.
Yeah. I remember when I was at Chenrezig one year, Geshe Tashi Tsering was teaching on this practice, and he said, I'd like you to do this practice regularly. I'd like you to do it for an hour a day. We all had that look like, where am I going to find an hour a day? And I couldn't manage an hour, but I could manage a half an hour for a particular period of time. And what I enjoyed about that was looking around throughout the day thinking, who will be my stranger for my meditation tomorrow? Yeah, and really noticing them. You know, otherwise we just don't even notice the strangers.
I think the observation that I still am astounded at and I don't recognize is what you said from the time we get up in the morning to the time we go to bed at night. I want to be happy. And how do I do that? I'm so unconscious of the self-referencing to the level that it goes on that I have to have such a strong intention to turn my attention to others and to think about perhaps they have the same feeling, they have the same wish. And because it's so innate that I don't even realize that that's what I'm doing, that I'm looking for happiness, I'm trying to avoid suffering. I'm on autopilot most of the time. I'm just going through my day trying to have a kind motivation, but I'm not tracking that this is the mind that's actually driving this action. Mm-hmm. This is the mind that's driving that action. I'm either trying to get happiness or I'm trying to work out how to avoid a certain kind of suffering. So I have to really turn my mind away from my own self-happiness and my whole own suffering avoidance to be able to do the practice. And when I can do that and resonate with how deeply this whole thing that Venerable said the other night, as intensely as I do, I don't realize how intense and compelling and automatic this is. And if I can connect with that, then when I look at somebody else, then I can resonate with that relationship. But until I see the intensity of how I exist looking for these two things all day long, it's hard for me to connect.
I remember when I first started listening to public talks by His Holiness, and he would often start by saying, we all want happiness, we all want to be free of suffering, and that puzzled me, like, why would he start with something so obvious? It took me a long time to realize that it wasn't obvious at all, you know, the depths of that deep, innate desire, yeah, that's driving everything, like you said. Yeah. Okay, so perhaps this reminder, actually in the book I think he suggests that we go through our day just thinking silently to ourselves, just as I want happiness, so this person also wants happiness, just as I want to be free of suffering, this person in front of me right now also wants to be free of suffering. So it's a good mental training, better than a lot of the stuff that usually goes on in my mind anyway.
For myself, I need to remind myself, what does it mean they want happiness? Like, this guy is taking meth. He doesn't want happiness, but I have to remind me, for him, this is happiness. He's suffering and thinking that meth makes him happy. Stealing, we're going to say, that's not happiness. This guy thinks having that TV or having that whatever will bring happiness to him. So I need to think like that. This is what it means for them, happiness.
Yeah, and I think we can even bring that much more closely to ourselves when we get angry with others. We erroneously think that's going to make us happy, don't we? So we can apply it on all levels across the board to ourselves and to others, yeah. Yeah, even though things may look like, actions may look like, we know they're going to bring suffering, but it's not obvious to that person who in that moment sees happiness through that action. That's a good point.
Doing mindfulness of feelings this winter really made me think about how we're doing this. Every moment of thought has feeling and has, and we're responding to that. And we're responding to the feelings of, you know, mostly to feelings of pleasure and unpleasant feelings. And we're doing that momentarily, probably without much thinking about it. We're just whatever, you know. And so it's constant, and it's not even on an, you know, this, we're not even aware of that little, each little impulse of that.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of goes along with what Venerable Sankyu was saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that meditation on mindfulness of feeling is a very important meditation for us to have, to raise our awareness of how that's true, that we're wanting happiness all day long. Okay, let's go to the next section, which is Kamala Shila encouraged us to look at this from our own point of view. So from our own point of view, developing equanimity is mainly based on understanding the uncertainty of our relationships with others in this life. Does that ring a bell from the middle scope? That's one of the six general sufferings of samsara, is that the uncertainty of cyclic existence, the uncertainty of our relationship with others, and it goes hand in hand with two others, that we're constantly dying and we're constantly taking rebirth. The middle scope is very important for actually as a foundation, as a platform for moving to the great scope and the development of bodhicitta. If we can understand that there is no starting point to the beginningless rebirths that we've taken, that's a big if, isn't it? Then generating this kind of equanimity won't be difficult. But we can begin with something we can relate to very easily, and that's by thinking about the changeableness or the changeability of the relationships that we have experienced in this life. So if you think back, who were your very good friends 5 years ago or 10 years ago? And how many of them are still really good friends? How many of them have become strangers? Maybe a few of them have even become enemies. Probably there's a lot of change, isn't there? For some, maybe others have more stable long-term friendships, but I imagine that we could identify a lot of changeability there. Who we count as friends and who we count as enemies actually changes dramatically. Even within one day, one person can play all three roles, can't they? Just a few sharp words and the category switch. The Lama Rim says that as much as we desire the constancy of friends and foe, it's a quality that we will never find. I think maybe except with the exception of the Three Jewels, there we can find a constancy of friend. But with ordinary sentient beings like ourselves, forget it. A person who is a dear friend in one life may become a hated enemy in the next. Of course, this is very difficult for us to realize because we can't realize it directly. These are extremely hidden phenomena. And so to help us understand this, then we can rely on authoritative scriptures. There's some interesting quotes that are often brought up in this section. From Nagarjuna's letter to a friend, he says, "One's father becomes one's son, one's mother, one's wife, and the person who was an enemy becomes a beloved friend. There is no certainty in cyclic existence." There's also that famous quote by Shariputra, who was known for his clairvoyance, so he could see these things. "He eats the flesh of his father and beats his mother while she sports with the sworn enemy upon her lap." You remember that one? In a former life, the fish that he was eating then had been his father. He, you know, due to rebirth, he was reborn as a fish because he loved fishing. born in the family pond, and or reborn. And he's now, the man is now hitting the dog, who was his mother in a former life, who is also wanting to eat the fish. His current wife is nursing their baby, who had been the sworn enemy in a previous life. And so think about it. Can we actually know with certainty about the relationships that we've had with anyone before? You know, look around the room. We've all been everything to everyone. And the fact is that benefit in the past is equal to benefit in the present. Harm done in the past is equal to harm being done now. If someone helped you last year and someone else helped you this year, both are equal in having helped you, even if you can't remember it. So we need to familiarize with this uncertainty of cyclic existence again and again to challenge that strong appearance of friend and enemy and stranger, which is often based on just a very short amount of information from one life. If you think about beginningless lives, and then we identify someone as a friend or a stranger or an enemy, just based on, you know, the short experiences of one life. That's, and even within this life, often it's very short. You know, someone says harsh words to us once, and they're an enemy for life. Okay, so again, let's bring to mind the friend, the enemy, and stranger from before, and just reflect for a moment. Just reflect how the dear friend or the loved one. We've had countless relationships with this person. They have been a stranger to us in countless previous lives. We could have passed them in the street and not even recognized them. Someone we didn't even know. And also, they have played the role of our enemy in previous lives. Chances are very good, given that we've had beginningless lives. So we could think about different family members, different friends, our partners, children. And then call to mind the stranger we identified previously. That person who appears as someone we don't have much connection with has been extremely dear to us in previous lives, as our family member, as our friend, as our teacher, maybe as our child. And that stranger also has played the role of an enemy. And finally, calling to mind the enemy or the difficult person, the challenging person. They haven't always been challenging to us. In previous lives, they have been our loved one, been very dear to us when they were our family member, our friend. And that person also has been a stranger. We've had that relationship with them in countless lives as well. So we're just doing these reflections very quickly tonight, but these are things that we can take to our cushion and really think about and actually call to mind many different people and apply this kind of logic and reasoning or this kind of inference that we're developing. And when we develop some equanimity based on thinking of specific people like these three people we've called to mind tonight, then we can begin extending this attitude to larger groups. And eventually, they say, eventually we can genuinely apply this to all sentient beings. If we start by applying it to all sentient beings, it's too general, it's too vague, and it won't have much depth. So we start with individuals. And then we come to see how pointless it is to develop prejudice of attachment and aversion based on short encounters of this one life alone. So by reflecting on this again and again, at least they say that manifest forms of attachment and aversion won't even arise in our mind. Wouldn't that be nice? I haven't gotten there, not even close. But, there are moments, and especially after we've done a very strong meditation, if we can maintain that awareness through the morning at least, at least through breakfast or maybe halfway through the day, maybe it will extend through the day. Slowly, slowly, as we develop that familiarity, we can extend it to influence more and more of our thoughts throughout the day. So that's cultivating equanimity based on our own point of view. that every living being has played all three roles countless times in previous lives. So again, just to mention that when we do this meditation, we're not trying to invalidate our friendships with people. That's not our objective. We'll still feel closer to some people. We have strong karma with some people, maybe not with others. But we're merely trying to target the obsessive mind of attachment and aversion and to neutralize it. So as Venerable said, we don't have the highs and the lows, but rather we have this equal, warm-hearted, open, caring regard for others as a basis, an internal basis for then going on to develop the sevenfold instruction of cause and effect. Okay. So the next step, the first step in the seven, is recognizing that all beings have been our mothers. Now, if we were Tibetans or Indians or and we had some understanding through our upbringing, our conditioning, that we had a continuum, a mental continuum, a beginningless mind, this would be easier for us. But even so, His Holiness says that this first point is not easy, and it's something that we have to put some real effort into, and it will take quite a long time to develop. But we can't really progress without it, so it's important to give it some attention. And the main logic and reasoning that we rely on to understand that all beings have been our mothers, specifically focusing on that relationship, because that's typically the closest relationship that we have in our lives. That's not true for everyone, but in general we can say that. So if you've had difficulty with your mother of this life, then perhaps there's someone else you can use in that role, maybe a grandmother or someone else who was a primary caregiver for you. So the primary logic and reasoning that we rely on is establishing that the continuity of our mind is beginningless. So that's not easy, is it? But how do we come to that understanding? Well, as a person, we're made up of a body and a mind. And if we think about it for even a few minutes, we can understand that our body is changing moment to moment. We can understand this by thinking how we've changed over the years or by looking at a succession of photographs. I remember at my father's prayer service before his funeral, you know, as you do, you show when he was a little boy and when he was a young boy and then when he was in high school and when he was going off to the army. And, you know, I'd never really thought about my dad as all those different beings, like he was a different being in every one of those moments, in every one of those photographs. Really gave me an appreciation for the continuity of this person I called my father. So we can do that with ourselves too, lining up some pictures of ourselves. So our body is constantly changing. Our mind is constantly changing too, isn't it? Literally, moment to moment. And since we're made up, we as a person are made up of a body and a mind, then we'd say the person is changing moment to moment as well. We're an impermanent phenomenon. Would you agree with that? That's pretty straightforward, isn't it? But what makes this first point difficult to understand is that unconsciously we're thinking of ourselves as permanent. So that's the hurdle that we have to overcome. So if you just think for a moment, think I, and just notice what appears to the mind. I. You know, who's sitting here? Who's thinking? Who's meditating? Does a constantly changing body and mind appear to your mind? Or does something more solid, more permanent appear? Generic image of a permanent person. What about when you look in the mirror? Do you see a constantly changing body and mind? Is that what appears to you? Or is that what you recognize? Is that what you apprehend? What about when someone criticizes you? At that time, do you think, oh, they're criticizing a constantly changing body and mind. I can let this just go through me. Or if you're asked to describe yourself, do we even think to include that in the list? You know, I'm a woman, I'm an American, I'm a constantly changing body and mind. And yet, at the deepest level, that's the basic reality of who we are. So this self-grasping ignorance causes us to appear very solid, very independent. But if we can begin to think of ourselves as a stream of consciousness that passes through a series of experiences called lives. I love that phrase. It's from the Bodhicitta book by Losan Gyatso. That we're a stream of consciousness that passes through a series of experience called lives. We can come to understand how there is no initial beginning of our mind, and therefore no beginning to our births, and also no beginning to the mothers required for those births. So let's do this reflection together. Notice how what we're thinking right now will experience who we are in an hour from now or tomorrow. What we're doing with our minds now will influence who we are tomorrow, right? And the mind we have right now is a product of the mind that we've had since this morning, all the different experiences, the thoughts, the activities that we've been involved in. So we can see that, we can understand continuity in that short segment of time, right? That's not too difficult. The mind we have today is a result or a continuation of the mind that we had yesterday and all the different experiences, all the thoughts. They've influenced the mind that we have right now and who we are as a person today. And if we trace back yesterday's mind was also influenced by the mind of the day before. Every conscious thought and experience we had on Wednesday has contributed to our mind right now and the person that we are. And we can trace back and back to understand that each day's mind is the result of the mind of the previous day. And so going back in this way, we discover that our mind is a continuity. We can come to a strong conclusion based on our own experience, can't we? That our mind is a continuity, changing moment to moment, and influencing each moment, influencing the next moment. Okay, so our mind is a continuity. Then think back to some of the thoughts and experiences you had a year ago. What were you thinking and doing in April of 2016? And just reflecting how all the thoughts and experiences from April of 2016 have also influenced and contributed to the person that we are today, based on this continuity of mind. And if we think back to the thoughts and experiences we had 10 years ago, making a leap now, 2006, what were we doing in 2007? All the thoughts that we had, all the experiences, all the conversations that we engaged in, all the entertainment we were involved in. And just get a sense of the continuity of the mind of the last 10 years and how all of that material has influenced who we are today. The mind we have today, the body, the person that we are today. That we are intimately connected. Those experiences are intimately connected with who we are today. And if we take a bigger leap, we can think back to our childhood. And again, noticing the continuity, most of us can strongly attest to the fact of how the experiences of our childhood have contributed to who we are today and the way we see the world, who we are as a person. Going back a little further, scientific studies have shown that even in the womb there is conscious activity, conscious awareness. And all of the experiences of ourselves as a fetus, as even as an embryo, as rudimentary as those experiences may have been, those have contributed to who we are today. And if we can imagine, just imagine continuing to trace back through each of those moments of the embryonic stages and arrive to the first moment of consciousness that met up with the sperm and the egg that our parents kindly gave us. Think of that first moment of consciousness. And then just reflecting how consciousness, mind, is impermanent. All impermanent things require a cause, a previous cause. A compatible cause, not just a random cause, it has to be compatible. And since the mind is non-material, then its cause must also be of a non-material similar type. In other words, that first moment of mind can't come from the sperm and egg of our parents because that's matter, that's not consciousness. And it can't be causeless, it's impermanent, it's a thing, it has to have a cause. And so what we can infer from that is that even that first moment of mind in this particular incarnation had a preceding moment of mind in order to be generated. And the mind doesn't just exist in space, you know, due to karma. It would be associated with a previous life, a combination of body and mind, a person. And so if we were to trace back even that initial cause of the first moment of the mind of this life, we could trace back through each moment of mind of that previous life, whatever life that was, as a human being or some other form, as a man or a woman. We could trace back and we would also find a first moment of mind connected to yet another previous life. And so in this way, we can begin to infer, based on logic, that the continuity of the mind is beginningless. So not only is our mind a continuity, but it's a beginningless continuity. There's no single moment of mind that we can point to as being the absolute first. And as we think about this, naturally we will come to the conclusion that if our mind is beginningless, then the number of rebirths that we've taken is also beginningless, infinite. And just as we've had beginningless rebirths, we're not talking about this body that's had these rebirths, but the mind stream, the subtle mind in particular, the basis of the mirror eye that goes from life to life. And so if we think about these points carefully, because we've had countless rebirths, then we must have had countless mothers to support those rebirths. So we've concluded 4 points so far, that our mind is a continuity. That continuity of our mind is beginningless. Therefore, the number of rebirths we've taken is also beginningless. Therefore, the number of mothers we've required for those rebirths is beginningless. Now, Buddhist texts usually say that there is a countless number of sentient beings. It's an unfathomable number. And there's still a doubt out about whether that there are infinite sentient beings or whether there are finite sentient beings. We still have to continue searching the answer for this. But let's just say there's a countless number of sentient beings. That might be difficult to work with. So let's just imagine that that there are 10 sentient beings. Just imagine, for simplicity's sake, for the exercise, there are 10 sentient beings, 10 mind streams, okay? And other than ourselves. And so if we trace back this life, we've had one mother in this life. One of those people played our mother. If we trace back our previous life, another one's played that mother. If we trace back 10 times, let's just say the probability is there's a chance that each one of them have played the role of our mother once. What about the 11th previous life? Whoops, now someone has to have played the role of our mother twice. You know, it'll be a different incarnation. It'll be the same mind, continuity of mind, but a different body. What if we trace back 20 times, 21 times? Now it's possible that someone has played the role of our mother twice, maybe even 3 times if you start looking at probabilities. And what if we keep tracing back and back and back and back beginninglessly? Then all those beings have played the role of our mother many, many times. So maybe that simple, very simplistic explanation or example can help us understand how mind streams, every mind stream that happens to be currently attached to a body has played the role of our mother countless times. So I'm just going to invite you to look around the room, look into each other's eyes, and just hold that thought. Oh, this person has played the role of my mother. And just notice what happens. It's interesting, huh? Hi, Mom. Do you feel something softening? That's the point, isn't it? Okay, but we're not going to stop there. It's not enough just to recognize that they've been our mother. Then we build on that. Okay, so that's one way to work with this idea, this first point, that recognizing that all sentient beings have played the role of our mother. So when we're doing that meditation, then we can take time to think about each person in our family. You know, our mother has been our mother countless times. Our father has also played the role of our mother countless times. Our sister and brother have not always been our sister and brother. That's just this one life. You know, it's like, what is it Jeffrey said? The pea and the carrot. How does that go?
Jeffrey said that our, many years ago, an analogy that our relationships are as adventitious as a pea and a little cube of carrot boiling in a pot of soup.
And coming together.
Yeah. And then boiling away.
And then going, the pea goes off with a potato and the carrot goes off with a green bean. Yeah. So thinking about family members, it helps us to have a different kind of holding relationships. Not quite so tight. It helps us to work with our attachment. Thinking about strangers also, that they've played that role for us. Also thinking about people we have difficulty with. They've also played those roles. That can be very helpful. Then we use that awareness that all beings have, in all probability, played the role of our mother. We take time to remember their kindness. And I love this meditation. You know, years ago when I started doing this meditation, I had done already a lot of therapy with my mother, so I had a good relationship with her. But what I noticed is that when I did this meditation, one of the side benefits was that my relationship with my mom in this life improved because I was really focusing on her kindness. So that's not the purpose of this meditation, but it's certainly a side benefit. So let's just take a moment to run through this experientially, if you're willing. So we're going to use the mother of this life, the relationship with the mother of this life, to understand the kindness of the mother, remembering their kindness, and then we can extend that to all the other mental continuums or beings who have played the role of our mother. So just reflect how our mother cared for us in the womb when we were just a little quivering mass of cells, and for 9 months, she was a captive audience. Think about it, 9 months, that's a lot to give a human being. Those of you who have been mothers understand that. And she fed us with her own flesh and blood for 9 months as we developed in her body. And she endured discomfort during her pregnancy, embarrassment. And she was willing to experience the suffering of childbirth to bring us into the world. That's a big gift. If that was all she did, we can thank her continuously. And at birth, we arrived with no clothes, no wealth, no provisions at all. And yet she welcomed us and showered us with her unconditional love to the best of her ability. We were utterly helpless for many months and years, and she took care of our every need. She loved and cherished us more dearly than herself. She kept us clean and dry, safe and warm. Think how many countless nappies and diapers she changed. She spent countless hours holding us and feeding us and cleaning up after us, smiling at us and cooing at us and teaching us our first words, teaching us to find our nose and our toes and our belly button. Chances are good she was there to help us take our first steps. And she protected us from so many harms. She made sure that we didn't get sick and took care of us when we needed it. And so due to her kindness, we were able to survive and to stay alive. Without that kindness, we would have died. And she underwent many hardships for our sake. The fact that we can hold a fork and a spoon and say please and thank you is due to the kindness of our mother. The fact that we know how to use the toilet is due to her kindness. She taught us many useful skills as we grew and matured. And so from our own direct experience, we can see how, merely in terms of ensuring our survival, our mother's kindness is unparalleled. Each of us could make long list of the countless sacrifices she made for our welfare. So just reflect for a moment that not only has she done that in this life, but she's done that in many previous lives as well when she played the role of our mother. Reflect for a moment how the father of this life has also played the role of your mother in many past lives and showed you this same magnitude of kindness. The same is true of our sisters and brothers, our dear friends. In fact, every person we meet has been this kind to us when they played the role of our mother in countless rebirths. So again, just take a moment to notice how this kind of, even just a short reflection in this way, impacts the heart, the mind. They say that we know we have accomplished this meditation when friends, enemies, and strangers begin to spontaneously appear as having been as kind to us as the mother of this life. So we can watch for that. I haven't found that yet. We can watch for that. I don't know what your practice is like. And so this brings us to the third step, wishing to repay their kindness. And actually, if we've done the previous two meditations really well, then naturally the wish to repay the kindness of the mother, sentient beings, follows. To the extent that we're able to reflect on others' kindness, a corresponding resolve to repay that kindness appears. And so then we need to investigate, well, how can we repay their kindness? There are temporary means. You know, we can try to provide them the happiness of this life, but as we also know from our study of the First Noble Truth, even the pleasures of this life are actually just the suffering of change. They're, if they provide any happiness at all, it's temporary, it's fleeting, it's unreliable, it changes. And so then we can reflect on benefiting our mothers in a more long-term way, being able to teach them to remove all the causes of suffering and to bring about the lasting causes of happiness. So the best way to benefit them is to provide them with the knowledge of the Dharma That's the supreme way to repay their kindness. Why? Because right now these mother sentient beings are controlled by karma and afflictions. And probably they lack understanding of spiritual goals like, you know, the causes for a good rebirth, the causes for liberation, the causes for enlightenment. Most of them don't have a reliable refuge. And probably right now most of them are engaged in negativity. You know, even if just benign attachment, it's a negativity. And so we can think with this attitude of, I am their child, it's my responsibility to repay their kindness and to bring about happiness and to free them from suffering. And so we can do this step just as a contemplation, just as we did before, starting with the friend, starting with the, and then moving to the stranger or the neutral people, and then the difficult people, thinking of them one by one and generating the thought, I will return the debt of kindness that I have with this person through helping him achieve happiness, helping her achieve happiness, lasting happiness. So these first three steps are designed to develop this, what was it, heartwarming love. Or appealing, that's how Geshe Tegchok described it, and Venerable too. Or another way of thinking about it is it helps us to see people in an appealing light, in a light that makes us want to help them. And so this order is very definite, and that heartwarming love, Venerable actually talked about that being the fourth step, so we can think about it in those terms. And then she said the order of loving kindness and compassion is not definite. That we could move to developing great compassion and great loving kindness in either order, which Venerable Somten is going to review for us next week. So the first three steps are, and we'll post this. This will be on the web. The first three steps are to develop this heartwarming love. Then there's loving kindness, developing loving kindness, then developing great compassion, and then developing the great resolve. I think that's the term she used, the great resolve, which is where we think, I alone will bring this about. I will take responsibility to bring this lasting happiness and this freedom from suffering for all living beings without exception. And that too is considered compassion. It's also great compassion. So we have two types of great compassion there. And so that's why we can say that compassion is the substantial cause for developing bodhicitta. And if we've done all of those steps well, that will lead to the mind that aspires to achieve enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings. If we're still beginners at this practice, then maybe it gets us to the point where we think, I better understand what Buddhahood is. And then bodhicitta will come, you know, with time. Okay, so that's what I have to offer tonight. Do you have any questions, any comments, Venerable Tarpa? Our mind is a continuity. Our mind is a continuity. So we're repeating the four conclusions. Our mind is a continuity. Our mind is a beginningless continuity. Therefore, we've had beginningless rebirths. Therefore, we've had beginningless mothers to give rise to those rebirths. Yeah.
Some comments that I missed online when we were contemplating friends, enemies, and strangers for the equanimity meditation. One person said, when I contemplate my enemies, it lightens my anger towards them. And someone else says, I feel more motivated and inspired to help people I don't like. Because if they want what I want, then I can connect on the level of being in pain and just wanting it to stop, to feel okay.
Wonderful.
Kamala Shila, where do you find his commentary?
It's from his Second Stages of Meditation. I'm not sure where the quote was. It could be Lama Rinpoche. I wouldn't be surprised.
This is a little bit of a tangent, but it's very good explanation of why the continuum of consciousness is beginningless. But do you know a good explanation of why it is necessarily endless?
E equals mc squared, maybe? Energy doesn't go to waste? Yeah. Why would it end? Well, certain minds do end, don't they? Like, afflicted states of mind can come to an end because they can be opposed.
But I'm talking about the continuum being endless.
Right. Is there anything that would oppose mind in general? Just mere clarity and awareness. You know, is there any other state of mind that would oppose it, or any other thing that would oppose it? That's where I would go with it.
Okay, thank you.
But keep thinking about it. See what you come up with.
When thinking of beginningless time and having countless mothers, I feel it being linear. And it seems that for all beings to have been my mother, it would need to be expanded, not linear. How can I expand this beyond the linear?
Well, I think the vegetable soup is a good analogy, that if you had a big pot of soup and you had, say, 100 vegetables in there, 100 pieces of vegetables, and you were counting, you know, how they were all interacting, when they were bumping into each other, and looked at all the different probabilities of how that would happen, I don't think it would be, I mean, it would be linear, but it would also be happening at the same time. Like, I only have one mother in this life, but, you know, the mother from my previous life, who knows where she is and what, you know, what that mind stream is doing now. I don't know if that helps, but that's what comes to my mind. Anybody else?
For me, what I would have to do to move my mind from that would be to let go of the logic and go into the experience of kindness. You know, I'd have to get to the feeling level of any part of the practice. I mean, I have to understand it logically, and that helps me, but it's not going to move me until I get to the place where I'm feeling this, my own suffering, the way you brought it out tonight, you know, and realizing, like what you said, wow, we feel ours, but we can't feel the other. So we need to, you know, the way they teach it in the Sakya tradition, in their refuge thing, is we infer this suffering of others from our own experience. So we have to get in touch with our own, as you said. And it has to be in the level of experience and heartfelt, you know, it can't stay in the intellect. That's what I would have to do.
Yeah, and again, coming back to this idea that I want happiness, I want to be free of suffering. We can say those words, but I remember in my own experience, there was a particular time where I went, oh my gosh, I want happiness. You know, like the penny dropped, and I could see how I was seeking that in all the choices that I was making through the day. Of course, you know, we forget that. But all right, so I invite anybody who's listening to do these meditations this week. Like, really make this a focus of your practice so that we're ready for next week's continuation. Yeah. And just because there's so many countless benefits to developing bodhicitta,